minutes ago. Looking real good in my passport photo.
Amateur Traveler, episode 205. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about stupas, koras, and altitude sickness as we go to Nepal. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Before we get into today's interview, I do have three news stories for you. The first one you probably heard about already, and that's the Delta Airlines flight that overflew their target, the Twin Cities, by 150 miles. There's not a lot to add to the story that hasn't already been said, except that remember the word Delta means the distance between what your expected results are and your measured results. Delta Airlines. And in the second news story, this is a bit of a news of the weird sort of story. There is a Mexican human rights activist who has been detained by the U.S. not because he asked for political asylum, but because he expressed that he might be in some danger and therefore was automatically entered as if he had asked for political asylum. He says he doesn't want it. He may get it anyway, or he may not, but until they decide, he's going to be held in the U.S. I don't get it. And our third story is a much more easy-to-understand story. Virgin America is planning on doing an experiment where they board the people on the plane who have no carry-on luggage, because they can get in their seats faster if they're not struggling with their bags and trying to get them into the overhead bins. So those also happen to be, of course, the people who probably paid to book their luggage and therefore made a little extra money for the airline. But I'm sure that's just me being cynical. If you're looking for links to these news stories and other news stories, check out the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. I'd like to welcome to the show John Miller, who's come to us from the rest of Everest to talk to us about Nepal. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, Chris, and congratulations on recently turning the corner on 200 episodes.
Well, thank you. We've certainly talked about having you on the show for a while. We're trying to figure out, John and I, whether it's been 2 years or 3 years in the making since I originally invited John on, but it just schedules being what they are. We're just finally getting around to it.
Yeah, so we met in the exotic location of the Ontario, California, just outside the conference center there for a podcast expo.
Right, so actually just outside the In-N-Out Burger, I think, which is a little more exotic than that.
But
So, Nepal, you've been there how many times?
I've been to Nepal 3 times.
Including leading a tour there with, I know, Chris Marquardt, we were just talking about from Tips from the Top Floor, a photography podcast, just this last year.
Yep, just in May, just 6 months ago.
Why should someone go to Nepal? Why do you keep going back?
The first time I went to Nepal, I was invited to join an Everest expedition, and I'm a filmmaker, and I was brought in to document an expedition to Everest. I thought I was going to Nepal to get to Everest. That trip, we were going to be climbing from the north side of Everest, which was in Tibet. So at the time, I only spent a few days in Nepal on the way in and the way out, going through Kathmandu. But I was thinking, okay, I'm going there for Everest. But after living out there for 2 months out of a tent with just a tremendous Sherpa staff, it really became clear to me that I like to visit Everest and Nepal and Tibet for the cultural aspect of it.
Hmm.
I always kind of say Everest is the excuse, but the people, especially the Nepalis, they're really the reason. It's a very rich culture. In Kathmandu, it's a large city, and so you do get a bunch of different types of people, but primarily the religion in the Kathmandu Valley and in Nepal, everyone's either Hindu or Buddhist. There's a lot of crossover between the two religions, and it's just the Buddhism in particular, it's so very friendly. The Nepali people are so incredibly friendly and make you feel so at ease and so happy to be there. And they're truly happy to meet even just standard tourists. Sometimes you can really feel like when you're traveling to some location around the world that you're really kind of being given up a sales pitch on different things. But they'll really chat you up for a while. They ask a lot of questions about you, not just telling you about them. So I love the people, and that is the reason I keep returning, and I'm going back just about every year now.
Excellent. Now, when you first went there, I'm guessing since you were just going, you thought one time probably, and to shoot video, that you didn't speak any of the language?
No, didn't speak a word. Nothing. I knew how to say namaste.
Okay.
At the time, I didn't fully incorporate just kind of what that means.
When you say fully incorporate what that means, I think of that as just thank you. You're saying it's a richer meaning than that.
Yeah, it's a richer meaning. I'm going to probably butcher the translation, but the way that I take it is the divine in me recognizes the divine in me.
Oh, I have heard that. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, it's really cool. And so often, especially when you're at Everest, you'll be walking around and it's a really international community when you're at this mountain during the spring climbing season. There's hundreds of people around from all over the world. And so many of the teams, it never really occurs to me why they do this, but they'll say just as they will pass a local, they'll say, hello, hello, hello. And the locals, whether being Tibetan or Nepali, they'll say hello back. But when you meet a local and you say namaste, their faces will light up. And they look at you right in the eye and say, namaste. Like they recognize that you didn't have to say it in their language.
Mm-hmm.
The culture is so important to them out there. They light up and they're like, hey, thanks for that. I appreciate you respecting us to greet us in our own language.
So to get over the language barrier, you've generally done tours or you've done a mixture of tours and independent travel by now?
Independent travel is not really all that possible in Tibet these days. So you have to have a guide with you, but like it might just be me and another friend of mine and then a guide and maybe a driver. The trip that I took a group on to Everest in Nepal, in the south side into the Khumbu area this spring, let's see, we had 9 clients and a staff of about, I think, 16 or 17 Sherpas. Porters, cooks, kitchen help, and then guides. And so I actually really enjoyed having that big group because you get to spend so much time with so many locals and they get to know you and you get to really spend time talking with them and getting to know them. So I got to know a little bit more of the language for that trip. But really, trekking and guiding Western clients into the Himalayas is such a huge industry out there. Mm-hmm. The Sherpas who are guides, they really are fairly fluent in English. So English is something that you can always speak. And up into Tibet, it's very common to find people speaking English as well. So it's actually pretty convenient for someone who hasn't got much of a grasp of the local languages.
So, and I understand there's a great big mountain there. Are there other things that we should see while we're in that area?
No, Everest is it. No.
That's it. Just a great big mountain. Okay.
Just a big piece of rock.
Well, John, thank you very much for being on the show.
Hey, thanks a lot, Chris. I said before, Everest is sort of the excuse, but there's so much stuff out there. Kathmandu is really worthwhile in visiting. It is, like I said, it's a large city. It's kind of, I'm not even going to say control. It's completely chaotic. There are so many people. The traffic, if you've spent any time in a third world country, you're going to be probably fairly familiar with the fact that in countries outside the U.S., especially third world, they basically drive with their horns.
Oh, sure. Okay.
Completely inappropriate here in the U.S., although however much you would love to drive with your horn.
You didn't live as much on the East Coast, I can tell, but okay.
There's so many people. There's so many vehicles. There's a lot of incense burning everywhere. There's these little temples. They're called stupas.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of all over the place. And in the Kathmandu Valley are two probably the most famous Buddhist temples in the world. One is up on a hill, and it's called Swayambhunath, and it's known by the tourists as the monkey temple because there's a lot of monkeys just walking around and panhandling and all kinds of stuff. It's a pretty striking place. It really is up on this hill overlooking the entire valley. It's quite striking. There's also Budnath, which is the largest Buddhist stupa in the world. It really is enormous. That's not up on a hill. It's surrounded by this circle of buildings. A lot of them are restaurants or tourist stores. But these are really important pilgrimage sites for the devout in Nepal and from different areas around the world where Tibetan Buddhism is really important. And they're so old that no one really knows how old they are. They're at least 2,000 years old, but just the historical record doesn't really have too much of an idea of when these stupas were built. And you really get that sense of how old they are because of the Tibetan Buddhist culture. There's people performing koras, which are circumambulations around the central spire. of these stupas. They're great big like towers, these religious temples. You always perform a kora by walking around the structure in a clockwise fashion. You always walk clockwise. That's the tradition. And there are prayer wheels lining the circumference of the kora, the walking path. And so there's people spinning prayer wheels and burning butter lamps and just constantly praying and chanting Om Mani Padme Hum. And it's very exotic to sort of our Western sensibility. And it's, mm-hmm. it's just wonderful. It's just wonderful.
And as a tourist, as somebody who is not Buddhist, and I'm not Buddhist, are there things that I should know culturally, do's and don't do's in the Buddhist temple?
You basically want to just look around and see what people are doing.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty interesting. You'll see people praying. You'll see people getting down on their knees. It's a pretty extreme gesture of their devotion. And mm-hmm. if it was a Christian ritual, you'd really feel like you were intruding if you were watching. But out there, especially among the people following the Tibetan Buddhism, they really want to share the culture. They really want to share what they know, what they do. And so it's very common to be able to photograph people and get right in there and talk with them. And more often than not, even if they don't speak English, they're more than happy to just sort of communicate with you however they can, whether it be through smiles or shaking your hand or putting their arm around your shoulder while you walk a kora with them. It's a very open culture. They relish seeing people who are interested. But probably the biggest thing you want to do is whenever you're walking around one of these stupas, you always want to be walking clockwise. So always pass, always go towards the left.
Okay.
What everyone's doing.
Yeah, so I would guess that would be fairly obvious.
Yeah. you don't want to go against the grain. It's the culture.
Okay. Other things to see in Kathmandu, as long as we're focusing on that for a second.
Well, there's Kathmandu Valley has a lot of different communities in it. They're all old. And there are just almost an infinite number of different little stupas. And I actually have a friend in Kathmandu. She's actually American, but she owns a store in the tourist district in Kathmandu called Tamel. That's the tourist district. That's where most people will spend time in a hotel when they're in Kathmandu. She's lived in Kathmandu for years, and she said one of the most amazing things is when she would just explore and try to like count as many little temples as she could. There's so many. I think actually Kathmandu has the most number of temples in the world. They're everywhere. She says some of them are just totally beautiful, these little gems that no one knows about. So that's something I hope to be able to do in the future, is have the time to really kind of go on a little stupa kind of roundup. But there's also some other communities, and one of the most popular is going to the city of Bhaktapur, which is another very, very old city. It's known as the city of art and architecture in Nepal. And so there's all of this ornate architecture, and it just has all these kind of different influences. It looks like it might be very, very Asian, very Indian, a great mix. And it's fully preserved. There's a square there that it's all off limits to vehicles. In fact, most of the really old part of the city is completely off limits to vehicles. So it's just all pedestrian traffic. And all these buildings are just incredibly ornate with all kinds of carvings around them. And it's really, it's just a beautiful, beautiful place to visit. Usually people will do it as a day trip out of Kathmandu. It's very worthwhile. When I went there in 2003, and actually Chris Marquardt visited there this year and really enjoyed it as well. Right when you get to the gate, you'll see a bunch of people trying to see if they can come along with you. And a lot of these are just teenage students who they kind of make a living by seeing tourists come up, and then they try to just walk around with you and tell you everything. And these guys are very detailed in their knowledge of the buildings and the architecture and what the different carvings mean. If you see any text carved in, what those characters mean and everything. We had this 16-year-old boy named Kaywan who came along with us, and he just was this fountain of knowledge. It was wonderful, and he just gave us such a great understanding of everything and just so pleasant to be with that you don't have to pay, but if you felt that you really got a good value out of what he said, then give him a tip. And so we paid him actually handsomely, since we are also filming everything that he was saying. So we wanted to honor him, you know, in the footage by using him in the footage. Yeah, we paid him very well for the local standards, but for us, it wasn't all that much at all. It was really affordable, and we just had a great time.
What's the best day you've had in Nepal?
The best day?
Yeah.
Definitely one of the best days I always have is the first evening whenever I fly into Kathmandu, because I'm just always so happy to get back there. And usually the times that I've gone in the height of the climbing season in the Himalayas, but it's not peak tourist season. Peak tourist season is going to be in the fall. So I'm always usually there in April or May.
So climbing season is when?
In the spring.
In the spring, really?
From late March to early June at the latest, because then the annual monsoon comes up in the Bay of Bengal. The mountains just get dumped on with feet or meters of snow, as the case may be. So, but I live in Colorado. I live up at about 6,000 feet in the foothills of the Rockies in northern Colorado. So it's usually a little bit cold whenever I leave home, and then you get to Kathmandu and it's 80 degrees, and I love being there. Kathmandu, I find, at this point in my visits, I find very relaxing. There's actually a certain cafe and restaurant that I really like visiting in the tourist area.
And do you remember the name of it? Or?
Oh, of course. It's hard to forget. It's called the New Orleans Cafe and Jazz Club, I think it's what it's called.
So it's a traditional Nepalese.
It's very much Tamil, the tourist district. There's so much of it has American names and everything. But you get inside there, you go down a back alley, and the restaurant, for the most part, is open air in this little courtyard in these buildings. And it has all these very Nepali architecture inside there. The food is really good, and they offer everything from burgers, which I think is actually not cow. I'm not quite sure what animal. It's not yak. There's sort of a half cow, half yak animal that I think they use. I actually always get dal bhat, which is the traditional Nepali meal that almost every Nepali in the country eats a couple times a day. And it's rice with a lentil soup that you pour over the rice. And there's all kinds of different like pickled vegetables and different things you can get, vegetarian or chicken and stuff like that. But it comes on a large stainless steel cafeteria tray. And almost anywhere I've been in the country, it's served on these stainless steel cafeteria trays. It's almost, whenever I have it at home here, it's just like, it's not quite the same because I'm not on a big stainless steel cafeteria tray. But with all the different compartments, you know, like on a TV dinner with everything filled with something else. But that's what I always get. It's always very good. Also, I've been there enough, and because I film everything, some of the wait staff there has gotten to know me, and they've seen themselves appear in the podcast, so they get a kick out of that. And one of the waiters, one of my friends, his name's Krishna, and as soon as he sees me walk in every time, he's like, John, how you doing? And he takes care of me and the group that I'm with. I just really like there, and they have Wi-Fi, so it's nice to find the free Wi-Fi.
And you mentioned earlier, speaking of food and speaking of establishments, that most of the tourists stay in a particular location. The smart tourists stay there, or where should we stay if we go?
Well, typically when people are in Kathmandu, they're not there to visit Kathmandu. Kathmandu is sort of a way station on the way to beginning their trek. Obviously, Kathmandu has the airport. And it's the capital, so it's where you get your permits and visas and everything. The majority of tourists stay in Tamel, which, as I said, is the tourist district. It's this maze of streets. The streets all look the same the first, I'd say, couple of visits there. And there's embroidery shops everywhere, or you can get patches made or t-shirts made. And you can buy anything you would need for your climb or your trek. There's stores there with, it's all fake, like Patagonia, North Face, Mountain Hardware equipment. I like to call it Patagonia and like Mountain Hardware and the North Farce, because it's all just, all they do is they've got embroiderers. These guys are the best. They're the best at what they do, and they just embroider the logos on stuff, but it's actually not bad quality, but it's just not licensed. So, but you can buy anything, anything there. It's a trip. It can be a lot of fun. There's a lot of bars and pubs and restaurants, and there's always live music at night. You can get a lot of just amazing gifts there for fairly inexpensive prices, but the prices are about 1,000% more expensive in Tamil than if you were to just simply venture outside Tamil and go to some of the more kind of local Nepali places.
And is there a place that you would recommend to stay?
To stay?
Yeah. Should we avoid Temel and go someplace instead?
Okay. Temel is typically where you'd like to stay. I mean, you can stay. I know there's places to stay, like around Budnath, the large stupa.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people, they really enjoy that. But I would say that if you're planning on spending more time in the Kathmandu Valley, there's definitely other places that you can stay. Personally, though, since Kathmandu is only a place that I'll stay for 2 or 3 days at a time, and since I'll have a large group there, it's much more convenient for me to stay in one of these hotels. One of the things that's really convenient about staying in Temel is right now in Nepal, the entire country, there is a shortage of water, drinking water, and there's also a shortage of electricity.
Okay.
They call it load sharing. Well, they'll just...
Your electricity will go off for hours at a time.
For 12, 16 hours at a time sometimes. But all of the hotels in Temel typically have electric generators that they fire up. Mm-hmm. And they also truck water in. So especially if you're only going to be there for a very short amount of time before you hop on a plane to fly to start your trek, or if you're going to go up into Tibet, then you won't even really notice the shortages except for... In the hotel, you won't notice anything for the most part, but you will notice the stores will go dark during the day. But most of them are sort of open air anyway, so it doesn't make much of a difference to the tourist traffic.
Okay.
They all have large car batteries and inverters, so they can still run your credit card. gotta be able to run the credit
card. Well, sure. You've important things first. When you first went, what was your biggest surprise?
I think once we got up into the mountains... The biggest surprise was definitely the altitude.
Says the man who lives at 6,000 feet.
6,000 feet, yeah, that's nothing. Many people have visited, let's say, Rocky Mountain National Park.
Yep, been there.
4 million people come through every year, and 3.5 million come through in 3 months during the summer.
Right.
Rocky Mountain National Park has one of the highest continuous, well, actually has the highest continually paved highway in the country. It goes up above 12,000 feet.
Right, Trail Ridge Road.
And people will go out there and they'll kind of run around for a little bit and they'll say, oh yeah, altitude. And then they'll get in their car and they'll drive back down to 7,500 feet.
Actually, I don't remember running around. I remember walking and panting a lot.
But, and then stumbling, yeah.
Yeah. And that was about 11,000 feet, I recall. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
People will say, oh, you know, it wasn't too bad. I didn't get a headache for very long. But you're only going to be up there for half an hour, maybe an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you climb any of the mountains in Rocky, you might only be on the summit, let's say, of Long's Peak at 14,256 feet for half an hour, and then you head back down. But when you are in the Himalayas trekking and visiting some of these just beautiful areas, your minimum elevation for days at a time will be 12,000 feet. And so you're sleeping there, you're eating there, and it can be very difficult for people. And I say in my podcast, which I document a lot of this stuff, that altitude is the wild card. And you could be the most fit person in the world, and the altitude, you could get mountain sickness and it could just floor you. Or you could be not in great shape and not have any problem at all. It really is kind of interesting to see how that works out. One of the things I think would be probably good to let your audience know is that there are several tips you can do to make yourself as comfortable as possible, because really being at altitude for a day, 2 days, 3 days, 8 days, 2 months at a time is very different than just climbing a mountain and then descending an hour later. One of the things that I really encourage all of my clients to take advantage of is medications that are available to us now. That's actually fairly inexpensive. And there's one in particular called Dymox. Dymox is a very potent diuretic, and it also increases your respiratory rate. It really helps you to acclimate faster. It kind of gives your body an advantage, lets you metabolize the oxygen more efficiently. And when you are at 16,000 feet, there's about half the oxygen as you'd have at sea level. And since so many people do, let's say in this country, in the United States, they do live along coastal areas.
Sure. Mm-hmm. I'm a coastal area person myself, yeah.
that's a big jump in altitude.
Yeah.
Just the only thing to keep aware of is that for the first day, you might be peeing every 20 minutes. So you got to plan for that. And I mean, really peeing for 20 minutes. You'll actually impress yourself. Almost feels in your fingertips. You get all tingly, kind of like you're hyperventilating, because it does increase your respiratory rate. The difference between having Dymox and taking it and having it and not taking it is dramatic. It could make or break your visit. The other important thing to know about Nepal, especially when you're in Kathmandu, is do not drink the water. Don't drink tap water. You can get giardia from the tap.
Hmm.
That includes taking a shower.
Sure.
Keep your mouth tightly closed when you're in the shower. Brush your teeth with the ample bottled water that you can get anywhere for, about 10 to 15 cents a bottle after the exchange. But you're still going to get diarrhea. No matter what you do, you're going to get diarrhea when you're out there. So I highly recommend people go out there with a prescription of, let's say, Cipro, which is a broad-spectrum antibiotic. Flagyl is another one to have. That is actually a anti-parasitic medication. It's like an antibiotic, but for if you did have...
If you picked up a friend.
Yeah, you picked up a friend. Yeah, I've never had any parasitic infestations in my belly, but definitely the severity of bacterial diarrhea out there, it's stunning if you don't treat it. It really is. There is absolutely no difference between, let's just say, peeing and pooping. It's the same thing when you're out there. That can really be difficult. And so I highly recommend that people go prepared with medication and use it as soon as you hear that first rumble in your belly, and you'll be fine. One other thing, Chris, I wanted to say is just that so many people go, I really want to go out to the Himalayas and Nepal, but I'm completely sure that I'm going to get altitude sick and die. I think that the biggest risk when going to altitude is psyching yourself out. So many people, they're just convinced they're going to get sick.
Hmm.
What I've been telling all of my clients, because everyone has this concern, and I tell them, you're going to be fine as long as you just follow the simple rules set forth. And if you have any guides, they'll know exactly what you should be doing. And you really will be fine. I don't want anyone to be so scared of the altitude that they deny themselves this life-changing experience of going into the Himalayas and experiencing Nepal or Tibet. It's so worth it. And I know that all the people that I've gone out there with, it truly has changed their lives. And I'm not exaggerating. It's just, it's a wonderful part of the world. Just wonderful.
And my take is that unless you're summiting Everest, which obviously has some very real dangers, you know, we've had those terrible years where climbers have died, but unless I'm doing that, I'm not picturing that trekking around the Himalayas is incredibly risky.
No, it's not.
I think at altitude sickness, I may wish I died, but that's not quite the same thing.
Well, and you also know that if you do really get hit with altitude sickness, the number one solution is just to decrease your altitude, and
right,
it's not difficult to go down, but it's challenging.
Mm-hmm.
But the things that are most difficult are sometimes the things most worthwhile to do. And everyone that I've brought out there, I always find it really just fascinating to watch all of these people who have never been out there before, because what you'll see is that everyone will be pushed to their maximum limit. Whether it be mentally, whether it be physically, whether it just be emotionally. And everyone at some point will break through that barrier, that limit, that wall, and find that they've got reserves of energy or something that they just never knew existed. And for me, I know that that's always part of my experience. Every time I've been out there, I've hit the wall, and I've always surpassed it. And it really is very empowering. It's wonderful to feel that you just can't go on, and then you just rest for 5 minutes, and then you go on. And before long, you realize you've been walking for 2 more hours after you felt you couldn't take another step. That right there is life-changing. And I don't think a lot of people, when they're at home, really ever put themselves in that kind of challenging position. It's very easy just to kind of coast through your everyday life. And one of the wonderful things about traveling in the Himalayas is that you really do get put in these positions where you're challenged as much as you can possibly be, and you'll overcome it. It's very empowering.
And we're going to need to start wrapping this up a little, but
yeah, I can talk forever.
Yeah,
well, I can have a conversation with a tree, Chris.
And John has a podcast. He has really a lot more information. If you're interested in Nepal, if you're interested in Everest, check out the rest of Everest and find out a lot more information about the people. So we'll use that as the full reference. But I don't want to end it on diarrhea and altitude sickness. So I want you to think about the day that it was a hard day, and then you looked at this vista, and it was all worth it. What are you looking at?
I'd say probably one of the best or days, most incredible days that I had was when I arrived into Advanced Base Camp on the north side of Everest in Tibet. It was 2 days of walking up to 21,000 feet. So that was definitely my high point of altitude. That's the highest I've ever walked. That's actually higher than Mount McKinley or Denali in Alaska. I was really struggling from the altitude, but I didn't feel like I had a headache. I didn't have a headache. I didn't feel sick. I just couldn't move my legs fast enough. And I was taking a step about every 3 to 5 seconds. And if you actually count that out while walking across your living room, you realize it's going to take you a while to get across your living room. Now, I'm walking on top of a glacier. I finally walked into camp, and I was so physically exhausted that I sat down in the dining tent that they had set up there for our expedition. I just started uncontrollably sobbing because I was just so happy I didn't have to keep walking. Our cook, Dawa, who ended up becoming a very close friend of mine, he knew that that was the most difficult thing I'd ever done in my life. And he came up and he just put his arm around me and told me he was proud of me. And he had no reason, no need to do that. He's staff. I was a client. He didn't need to say anything. Came up and he just said, you know, I'm proud of you. What you did was really, it was hard. It's hard for everyone. And congratulations. You'll always have that you made it up here. And just to bring it back to, it's the people. That was a really important moment for me. And yeah, you were asking like, what was the view and everything? But the view was just looking at Dawa and just recognizing that I had earned his respect. That just meant the world to me. So here I was with Everest just right there, almost like feeling that you can touch the summit from 21,000 feet, even though it's almost 2 miles higher than you still. And all these glaciers, and you're looking off into Tibet and everything. But the most important thing was just I had made a new friend for life that day.
Excellent.
That's why I keep going back there. I keep going there for the Sherpa people, the Nepali people, and they mean the world to me. Absolutely. So, free Tibet.
And finish this sentence for me.
Okay.
You really know you're in Nepal. You really know you're at Everest, either one of what you want. When what?
When you hear a yak train pass you and you hear the bells on their neck and the yak herders whistling, trying to corral the yaks. You know, it's one of the really fortunate things about my show is that it's video, which means it's visual and audio. You get transported back. Every week when I create these episodes, I keep doing it because I'll hear or see something that you forget about. You don't remember it until you hear it or see it, or you're back there again. And then you might take it for granted. But hearing just some of the ambient noise of the Himalayas, it just transports me right back. It's as strong as maybe, you know, smelling some food cooking that you only get in a certain location in the world. And you're just like, you might smell it at home. And you're like, wow. All kinds of memories just flood back in. But yak bells do that for me.
And if you had to summarize in 3 words that area, what 3 words would you use?
My favorite place.
All right. Okay. We haven't gone there yet. I'm surprised in all the shows that I've been asking that question. John, thanks. I'm so glad we were able to have you come on the show finally and get a chance to talk about Nepal, Everest, a little bit about Tibet in there. And where can people find more about your show?
Well, therestofeverest.com is the place. If you really want to get a good overview of just sort of a slice of life from visiting the Tibet side of Everest and visiting the Nepal side of Everest, I've got 2 special episodes in my feed. One is from 2007 called the Tibet 2007 Teaser. That is an overview of the trip that I made when I returned to Everest specifically for my podcast in 2007. That was the north side in Tibet. Mm-hmm. And the teaser that I produced just in June of this year, 2009, the Everest Trek 2009 teaser. Those are extra long episodes. They're almost 40 minutes long each, and it will just give you a good overview of the experience of what it's like to visit both sides of the mountain. And I think anyone who watches them will probably get really excited to potentially visit these areas, and hopefully some of them will.
Great. I'll put links to both of those in the show notes for this episode so that people can find them more easily. John, thanks so much for coming on the show and sharing with us your obvious love for Nepal, Tibet, and Everest.
Thanks so much, Chris. I really appreciate it. A lot of fun.
I have one internet resource for you today, and that one is completely self-serving, and that is an announcement that the Amateur Traveler Video Edition has just gone high def. So if you are a subscriber to the what used to be the Apple TV version of that show, that has become the HD version. I haven't gone back and made all the episodes HD because I wasn't shooting with an HD camera until recently, but I made the last six or so episodes of that into HD, and so if you're interested, check that out. That is also hosted at amateurtraveler.com, but there are two separate feeds for it if you subscribe to the show, for instance, via iTunes. There's both a low-res feed and now the HD feed. A reminder, if you're interested in an Amateur Traveler trip, to fill out the survey, I had a conversation today for about half an hour to 45 minutes with a tour provider that I've had a relationship with for the last 2 years, and so I'm looking very seriously at doing trip or trips next year, and so I'd be interested in knowing where you want to go, so remember to fill out that survey. And you can find a link to the survey at amateurtraveler.com. In news from the community, I got an email from Michael here over the last week, and I asked Michael to put his whole email up as a comment on the episode about Lao, and so you can check that out, but I want to read part of it. Just wanted to say how much I love the podcast. I wonder why I wanted to read that part. Right now, I'm in Hiroshima, Japan, working for an exchange foundation that basically sends me out to the rural areas in Japan to interact with children, teenagers, and university students. It provides a safe environment for those children to interact with foreigners, and I get free train tickets and tours by locals of places in Japan where few tourists go. Anyway, I love listening to these podcasts on my way to work or on those long trips to rural Japan, but as I listened to your Lao podcast, I felt Sam misrepresented bus travel in Lao. I realize this is not his fault. He was pressed for time and could not take any long bus ride anywhere. I have to tell you, my favorite times in Lao were when I was on long bus rides. The locals are great, and they often could not communicate with words, but food was usually used as a medium, and people on the bus love to eat, especially on long bus trips. With kids, they will often share food with you. This is how I got to taste a lot of local fruits and some other foods I had not eaten in other parts of Southeast Asia. I remember I was on this long bus ride from the capital to the southern city of Pasc, and it was at least 20 hours. During the trip, I had some locals tour me around a fresh fruit market. I tried some street meats and sweet dishes, but my favorite memory had to be that on the bus I was on, they were showing a series of Thai horror movies, which I watched at breaks from my book. Though at one stop, the driver disappeared. He came back with food and a new movie, looks at me and smiles. He went to get a Bollywood movie that had English subtitles. It was hilarious. Here I am, the only foreigner on the bus, watching this Bollywood flick with English subtitles as everyone on the bus is looking at me and smiling. Even though it must have been in Hindi, no one complained, so I could watch something with English. Great story. Michael has more stories, but I'm not going to read his entire letter, so check out his comment on the episode in Lao. With that, we'll bring this episode of the show to a close. I'm currently working on a redesign of the Amateur Traveler site, and I want to get back to that. If you have any questions, feel free to drop me an email at host@amateurtraveler.com or leave a comment, as Michael did on an episode, if you have particular comments on that, especially if you have additional stories about your trip to that country. That'd be great to hear. Don't forget to fill out the survey. Check out the new site to see if I've updated it yet. And don't forget the new sites, humor.amateurtraveler.com, entertowinatrip.amateurtraveler.com, and traveldeals.amateurtraveler.com. There's just a plethora of Amateur Traveler available for you. And as always, thanks so much for listening.